The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. This article is in the books section, The Case for an Emotional Affair, A Letter-Writing Romance with an Ex Signaled the End of a Marriage and the Start of a New Life. When my children were very little, they invented imaginary friends. My youngest imaginary friend was named Oaken John. My oldest, in classic Psychology 101 textbook territory, named his bad guy. Oaken and bad guy went with us on car trips, required seats at the dining table, extra scorecards at mini golf. My children are 8 and 10 now, and Oaken and bad guy are no longer a consistent presence. But they still appear every so often. Last week, I heard my sons discussing where they thought they'd gone, what Oaken and Bad Guy had been up to since they'd last visited. My oldest said, "Oh, Bad Guy? He's been on a long vacation." I thought back to the days when Oaken and Bad Guy were daily visitors, and I would sometimes have to push them on the tire swing in front of our old Pennsylvania farmhouse, back when we still lived in that farmhouse, when we still lived with my son's father. I wondered where imaginary friends might vacation. I thought of my own imaginary friend, who was tall and lean and blonde. I'd named him Heathcliff, because I thought of him as part Wuthering Heights character and part Michael Penn song, A Romeo in Black Jeans. My younger son called me back to reality, back to our small suburban kitchen the three of us like to crowd into while I am cooking. I turned on the stovetop. Click, click, flame. I pictured all of our imaginary friends vacationing on a beach somewhere, relaxing and enjoying their time off together until we needed them again. Heathcliff, Bad Guy, and Oaken John, staring out to sea, their hair sandy, salt crusting along their sunburned necks. I also named him Heathcliff because that was pretty close to his actual name. In real life, he and I were together from our sophomore through senior years in college. He was the first man who could make me sigh just by watching him walk across the cafeteria at our school's Sunday brunch. He was tall, very tall, and thin, and a sort of relaxed amble whose slowness made me blush. He had long, spindled fingers and a delicate mouth. On the soccer field, he was fast and graceful, and I loved watching him walk home to me after practice. I would sit reading a book on a bench in front of his dorm and wait for his return. His blonde hair darkened with sweat, cleats slung over his shoulder, a low, slow grin breaking across his face as he drew closer and closer. One time, we both had the flu and spent 2 days hiding under a quilt in his dorm room. The edges of the world were soft but solid, and we moved by sound and smell and feel. I remember sharing an orange under that quilt, delirious from fever, both real and cabin, his thumbnail sliding under the skin of each segment, popping the fruit's small, juicy membranes. Our skin smelled like citrus for days. After college, we kept in touch the first few years, but then he disappeared. By the time my children conjured their own friends in the Pennsylvania woods, I had not seen or spoken to him in a decade. Although he worked in the tech industry, he had no digital presence, no Facebook page to stalk. He hadn't stayed in touch with mutual friends. He always held a space at the edges of my mind, but in an ephemeral, more than corporeal way, he turned into a ghost. Finally, at age 15th, college reunion, after a long and boozy night of reminiscing with friends and him not showing up again, I returned to my dorm room and swayed over my laptop. The plastic give of the single mattress, the dark whorls on the scarred wooden desk, the chemical smell of the industrial shower curtains, the verdant Hudson Valley air steaming through the window screen, Each sensory detail made me think of him. I found him, of all places, on LinkedIn, and hit send before I could think much about it. By the time I peeled off my clothes and climbed into bed, he'd sent a response. For the next 3 years, we communicated through boxes, the black rectangle of my iPhone, the square glow of my computer screen, and a few times a secret P.O. box in my small town. Our conversations were intimate, but chaste, detailed and serious, never untoward, not once. And yet, I told no one about him. Mostly, we emailed in a weekly, sometimes daily volley. We talked about work, about his boss, about my bookshop and job interviews, about his soccer team and his Bunker Hill neighborhood, about the hemlocks and wild turkeys on my property, my son's obsession with his blue rain boots. He wasn't married, or it didn't seem like it, though we were careful not to ask too much about those details. It took me a year to work up the courage to ask if he had any children. No, he said, not yet. My marriage had been fraying for years by that point, and now, rereading these hundreds of emails, I recognized the quality I missed most dearly from my relationship with my husband at the time. The emails are full of a congenial camaraderie and everyday knowledge and shorthand of our hopes and fears, cheerleading and soothing and propping one another up. This was the kind of talk I used to have over the coffee maker in the morning, or in the last moments before sleep at night in the early days of our marriage. It had been so long since someone seemed genuinely excited to hear from me, who wanted to know what I felt and thought and did during the day, who wanted to make me smile. I felt a slow burn throughout my body. Embers fanned and flamed. I was running a small bookshop and raising 2 children, and I collected things to tell him throughout the day. I was also making preparations to leave my marriage and my home. I never explicitly said to him that I was in the middle of this rupture, because we tacitly agreed that was off-limits, but he was my constant companion through it all, through the job interviewing, the boxing up and closing down of my bookshop, the search for a new apartment in a new city, the breaking down one life and building up an entirely new one. I used our correspondence as a stage upon which to create a character. Instead of sharing the money insecurities or the terrible final months of the late-night kitchen arguments or the crippling self-doubt, I built a narrative of survival. I chose my details carefully, crafting a story that starred a plucky fighter whose independence and verve were her defining features, someone on the cusp of flight, rather than the crash-landing failure it mostly felt like. I liked this version of myself, and the idea that I was building her for me, a kind of totem or trouble doll I could pull out from under my pillow any time I needed her. She almost became a separate imaginary friend all on her own. I liked that he gave me space to imagine myself this way, the confidence to build myself up. I told myself I deserved this kind of relationship, that I needed the strength it brought me, the brightness of humor and kindness, the tender that I could be, the reminder that I could be a person with whom another person wanted to exchange humor and kindness. But I knew what I was really doing. I was wooing him. At 19, I'd also pursue him hard. I'd returned early to campus my sophomore year for a student government orientation. He'd returned early for soccer. I heard about him before I met him, from a girl who hooked up with him the weekend before. She was an athlete, an extrovert, with dark hair and big, flashy, dark eyes, my opposite in every way. I wound up on a shopping trip with her at Kmart to buy craft supplies for an orientation event. She gushed about him as she flicked through carousels in the underwear department, piling cheap thongs in bright colors into the crook of her elbow. I remember thinking this was important, this detail, that she was a girl who bought sexy lingerie at Kmart, as if sex was a commodity as common as a box of cereal, a new water bottle. Her desire was contagious. I listened to her breathlessly rhapsodize about her feelings for him, how much she wanted him, and I wanted that, those feelings. I had a boyfriend at the time. He was away at Williams for the semester, and I liked him very much, but I'd never felt like that. There was an urgency, a physicality to her want. She was flushed just thinking about touching him again. So I co-opted her desire and its object, and I bought a pair of emerald green nylon string bikini underwear. When we were 19, it took a week of observing both him and the girl, of testing, of finding fissures, of holding back just enough to see if I could catch his eye during a party while she went out to smoke a joint. Then I just had to speak quietly so that he needed to lean down to hear me over the music, to touch his back lightly, bring him closer into my hair, near my neck. Meanwhile, I was clinical in my rationalizing. This girl was not right for him. She'd quickly find someone else. She was confident, and this would not really hurt her. Plus, we were acquaintances, not really friends. I justified every inch of it, but I knew exactly what I was doing, and I did it anyway. At the end of that orientation week, he and I found ourselves in the back of a van with a dozen other people. Another soccer player had driven the van to campus, and now it sat parked in front of the senior townhouses, a kind of outdoor cabana. Slowly, the van emptied out. We stayed. When we finally kissed, it felt inevitable. That we'd fallen into such an easy epistolary rhythm almost two decades later was no surprise. In fact, it had kind of been our thing. Nearly half of our college relationship had been conducted long distance. Our junior year, I'd gone to school in London, where he stayed stateside. Phone calls were too expensive. Cell phones didn't exist yet, and there was nothing like Skype or FaceTime available. Once a week, we'd use the library computers to sign into a UNIX program that allowed us to communicate real time. The screen was black, the text electric green, and you had to type commands like talk to start a session. And we would write and mail letters to each other, pages and pages of letters. Letters I realized I still had. My storage boxes were stacked precariously in a corner of the dairy barn that also functioned as my husband's painting studio. Battered and musty, these boxes had sat untouched for years. Books from college, souvenirs from my traveling years, trips to Thailand and Vietnam, Germany and Egypt, Israel and Spain. Two small albums of photos, a Doc Martin boot box of mixtapes. I had an entire shoebox dedicated just to his cards and letters. Turns out he'd kept mine too. On days when the boys were napping or sufficiently engrossed in a cartoon and their father was out, I'd stealthily make for the barn. I would open the box and sometimes just stare at the handwriting, the way he looped his H, the pressure of his pen and perfect spacing of his words. I liked taking the letters out, one by one, feeling their multi-paged heft, not even opening them, just trailing my fingers across the sandy brown envelopes, the red Par Avion stamps. On days I didn't receive an email, or even on days I did, I liked to hold the pile of old and weathered loose-leaf papers in my hands, blue lines translucent as veins, proof that I hadn't simply imagined him. This article was edited due to time. This article is in the lifestyle section. What is Juneteenth? Here's why we honor the federal holiday. Everything you need to know about why we commemorate June 19. A key American historical event finally received federal recognition in recent years. June 19, 1865, the day all people living in the United States, including the formerly enslaved, were officially granted freedom. On June 17, 2021, President Joe Biden signed a bill into law making the day known as Juneteenth, a national holiday. Reflecting what he'd also said about the 100th anniversary of the Tulsa race massacre weeks prior, Biden said, the same sentiment at the White House signing for Juneteenth in 2021. Great nations don't ignore their most painful moments. They don't ignore those moments of the past. They embrace them. Great nations don't walk away. We come to terms with the mistakes we made, and in remembering those moments, we begin to heal and grow stronger. Many of us in the United States have grown up with the idea that the 4th of July is about as American as you can get. People come out in droves to celebrate the holiday, which honors the adoption of the Declaration of Independence in 1776, with festive cookouts, fireworks, and red, white, and blue desserts. The national observance of Juneteenth provides a fuller and more accurate portrait of America's history beyond July 4th's celebrations. One-third of the people who signed the Declaration of Independence were slaveholders, including Founding Father Thomas Jefferson. The famous document did initially have a passage that denounced slavery, but it was removed in part to please the South, which relied heavily on the slave trade. And 1 year later, in 1777, with the publication of the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union, the enslaved were legally considered property as opposed to human beings, with the debate regarding whether or not Africans were considered other persons or property continuing for decades to come. As such, July 4th was founded on an idea of freedom created by a group of men who either believed they rightfully owned black people or were not willing to stand up to the atrocities of slavery in the United States. And, as former First Lady Michelle Obama reminded us in her powerful 2016 DNC speech, it was the enslaved who built the White House, a residence that represents not only the presidency, but American democracy and freedom. Not recognizing Juneteenth erased these historical facts, glossing over the racist ideas and policies that were integral to founding our nation. In 2020, in light of the national resurgence of the Black Lives Matter movement, amid the police killings of Ahmaud Arbery, George Floyd, and Breonna Taylor, the holiday took on an even bigger meaning for many Americans. Many, for the first time, were seeking to honor black lives lost in any way that they could, in order to honor and acknowledge the historical struggles of the community. I think Juneteenth feels a little different now, Mark Anthony Neal, a Duke University African and African American Studies professor, told the New York Times. It's an opportunity for folks to kind of catch their breath about what has been this incredible pace of change and shifting that we've seen. Below, the history and important facts about Juneteenth, the now successful case for making it a national holiday, and how it's traditionally celebrated. What exactly is Juneteenth? Juneteenth, also known as Emancipation Day, takes place annually on June 19th. The holiday is a combination of the words June and 19th. On January 1st, 1863, ahead of the third year of the Civil War, President Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation, which declared all enslaved people in the Confederate States, Alabama, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, South Carolina, Texas, Arkansas, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Virginia, were free. But Lincoln's executive order did not fully abolish slavery in the U.S., as it didn't apply to those held as property in bordering states who were loyal to the Union. Despite the proclamation in Texas, slavery was largely unaffected. The Confederates considered the state a safe space for slaveholders, as it remained generally unoccupied by Union Army soldiers during the war, mainly because it was one of the farthest away from the border between the Union and the Confederacy, aka the front lines of the Civil War. According to PBS, many rebels from neighboring states would flee to Texas with their illegal enslaved people. But on June 19, 1865, 2.5 years after the Emancipation Proclamation was signed and just 2 months after Confederate General Robert E. Lee surrendered, with the Union Army winning the war, Major General Gordon Granger arrived in Galveston, Texas, to take control. He issued General Order No. 3 to inform enslaved people that they were free and that the Civil War was officially over. This is why we celebrate Juneteenth, because it honors the day all of the enslaved were made aware of the Emancipation Proclamation and were officially legally released from their bonds. Later that same year, in December 1865, the ratification of the 13th Amendment formally abolished slavery in the United States. It reads, "Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime, whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction." Sam Collins of the National Trust for Historic Preservation and co-chair and president of the nonprofit The Juneteenth Legacy Project told the New York Times about what he considers to be a common misconception. He is a lifelong Galveston resident, according to the publication. Juneteenth was recognized as a state holiday in 1980, but our families have been celebrating Juneteenth since 1866, Collins told the Times. "I think what is so often lost is the story of the ancestors and elders that kept this history going by acknowledging the day even when the larger society wouldn't acknowledge it. Juneteenth didn't become important because it became a national holiday, and it didn't become important in 2020 after the unfortunate murder of George Floyd. It has always been important to the former enslaved and their descendants. Juneteenth is a national holiday. It's the first new federal holiday since Martin Luther King Jr. Day was established back in 1983. Further, it arrived at a time when multiple states were passing laws limiting what can be taught about race and American slavery in schools. Ironically, Texas, the first state to lead the charge in naming Juneteenth a formal state holiday in January 1980, was among the states in which lawmakers introduced multiple measures intended to limit how and what teachers could say about the history of slavery in the U.S. It was only in 2018 that the Texas Board of Education finally voted to acknowledge in school curriculum that slavery was a main cause of the Civil War. Prior to the 2021 law signed by Biden, Washington, D.C., and 48 states had passed legislation to recognize Juneteenth, though only a few states made it a paid holiday, where all workers are given the day off like July 4th. In the wake of global fights for recognition and equality with the Black Lives Matter movement in June 2020, both Virginia and New York declared Emancipation Day an observed state paid holiday. Corporations like Target, Nike, Twitter, the NFL, and Hearst Magazines, which publishes Oprah Daily and O Quarterly, have also declared June 19 a company holiday. If Juneteenth falls on a Sunday, the following Monday will be an observed legal holiday. If it falls on a Saturday, the preceding Friday will be an observed legal holiday. Hawaii became the 49th state to formally recognize the day on June 16, 2021, the same day Congress voted to approve it as a national holiday. And in February 2022, South Dakota became the 50th state to make Juneteenth an official state holiday when Governor Kristi Noem signed a bill. This article was edited due to time. This next article is in the Work and Money section. When life hands you a life coach. As their friendship morphed into a self-improvement mission, these military spouses set out on a path of empowerment and found eye-opening lessons along the way. When Kimberly Gladden Eversley, 33, a military spouse and mother of four, was in a rough emotional place while facing a second deployment, she had an epiphany. Military spouses needed support from someone who understood the challenges, and she could be that go-to person. Ultimately, she became a certified life coach, volunteering her spare time to helping other military spouses find and execute their purpose from beneath the shadows of their active duty spouse. Her training came in handy, most notably, when she befriended Aisha Shorter, 29, a stay-at-home mom struggling in her marriage to a military officer who needed help turning her situation around. Here's how their bond began, and when it taught the two of them, and what it taught the two of them about the resilience that's possible when someone commits to being in your corner. Kimberly says, "Years ago, while stationed in Groton, Connecticut, I started a jewelry line for military spouses. I wanted to create something that would allow active duty spouses to feel a sense of pride as they served our country without wearing a uniform. I would hand-deliver my custom-made jewelry to nearby customers, including Aisha. From the moment we met, I felt her positive and vibrant energy. She's quite the Southern Belle, naturally nurturing, generous with compliments, and with a smile that would encourage anyone to find joy in the simple things life brings. She was transparent. She was raw. She was truthful. And to be honest, she was me." Aisha says, "At the time, 2013, I was still a stay-at-home mom with a young daughter. When some people find out you're a stay-at-home mom, they say things like, 'You're so lucky.' Like, no, it's actually pretty draining. Your partner works so much you barely see them. And when they come back from a deployment, they can seem like a different person. You can't always talk to other women in the military community either. Some can be quite judgmental, especially when rank comes into play. But Kimberly, she knew from the beginning that my marriage wasn't working, and she provided the support I needed leading up to my divorce. We've been inseparable ever since." Kimberly, "I remember facing our second deployment right after giving birth to my third child. It was the first time I felt as if I were crashing and losing myself. My anxiety levels were higher than usual, which evolved into a continuous battle with panic attacks, irregular heartbeats, and vertigo. My stress was breaking me down mentally, physically, and emotionally. After a series of cardiology and doctor visits, I was diagnosed with anxiety disorder and offered medication to decrease my symptoms. I felt misunderstood by medical providers who lacked understanding and experience within the military spouse community. That's when it hit me. I wasn't alone. Spouses need support from someone who truly understands them. Eventually, I became the go-to person in my community. My biggest wins and triumphs finally happened when I released myself from needing permission to relentlessly be who I am." Kimberly, "What began as a friendship later evolved into mentorship, allowing us to build a deeper connection. Our conversations were like a pendulum swaying in whatever direction Aisha's emotions took us. Some days we laughed. Some days were full of tears. Coaching is a goal-oriented process. We use our grief as fuel to get the fire going and make our visions a reality." Aisha, "When she started coaching me, we did an intake session and made a vision board. It showed me going back to school to become a veterinarian, getting myself to a mentally stable place, buying a house, and just being happy. I knew my marriage was going down, so I was like, 'I gotta make money because I need to take care of myself and my child.' Kimberly said, 'Go back to school, be with the animals.' So I applied for a job as a pet care specialist at a specialty pet retailer and started school a month later. I eventually want to have my own veterinary practice, but I'm also thinking about getting my business license and starting an aquarium cleaning service, or baking birthday cakes for dogs. People always come into the store looking for cakes, and I'm like, I can make that." Kimberly, "Aisha's resilience was beyond anything I'd seen. I would hand her some tools, and she would hit the ground running. Watching her fulfill her vision while hitting every single goal we've set together is so inspiring. The pain that comes with closing some chapters in our life may be the key that unlocks the door to a future brighter than we ever dared to imagine. Divorce sounds daunting, but Aisha redefined what divorce is for the modern-day single mom." Kimberly, "People need people. People boast about their independence while failing to realize it is impossible to get anywhere without a tribe. We pray for help in the form of a miracle without realizing that a miracle may be your neighbor, your friend, your coworker, or a random worker at the post office. Despite the heavy loads we carry, there is always someone willing to lighten the weight if you let them. Bravery is not present in the person who bears the weight of the world alone, but the one who dares to be vulnerable enough for others to help carry it. Aisha, everybody needs someone to keep them on track, someone who can love you through your ugly, pick you up when you're feeling down, and remind you of your self-worth. I can tell Kimberly anything, and she's never judgmental. She holds me accountable for things I say I'll do, always checking in like, hey, where are you with this? And I in turn do the same thing for my daughter. In books, this article is Read Oprah's favorite chapter from her new book club pick, Bittersweet. In this adapted excerpt from Oprah's book club's 99th selection, Susan Cain reveals what happens when we lose love, how we can mourn it, and how we can survive. Discover more about this powerful section of the book from Oprah's talk with the author. One of my earliest memories, first afternoon of kindergarten, age 4, I'm sitting at a kidney-shaped table coloring blissfully. Yellow Crayola for a bright sun, green for the grass below, and between them a blue, blue sky. I glance up and there's my mother, standing with the other moms at the back of the classroom, waiting to take me home. She smiles her loving, endlessly patient smile, and I fill with joy. To me, it's as if she wears a halo encircling her curly red hair. To me, it's like being picked up from school by an angel and following her home to the Garden of Eden. Throughout my childhood, she was like this, ready after school with a dish of chocolate ice cream, happy to chat about fourth grade social life, always present with a gentle joke or when things went wrong to soothe my tears. My siblings were much older. My father was a medical school professor who worked long hours. I loved them dearly, but my mother was everything. Did a better, more loving mother exist anywhere on earth? That would have been impossible. All my friends said I was lucky to have a mother like her. She made chicken soup and pot roast and lit candles on Friday nights. She rarely raised her voice except to encourage things I said and wrote. She had taught me to read and write when I was 3. I soon claimed the floor under the card table as my workshop, and there, crouched beneath the tabletop, produced plays, stories, and magazines on lined paper stapled together. We didn't know back then that this act of writing would tear us apart, and I didn't know how complicated my mother actually was. She was an only child. Her own mother had been very ill throughout my mother's childhood, lying in bed for years facing the wall. What would it have been like? What might it do to you to see your mother's back turned, day after day, year after year? My mother was convinced that she'd done something horribly wrong to make her own mother so sick and tormented by an insatiable desire to be seen. My mother's father was a rabbi, loving, wise, and a twinkly, extremely devoted to his daughter, but mired in heartache. In 1927, at age 17, he'd come from Eastern Europe to Brooklyn on his own to get married. Only a decade later, when my mother was 5, he'd called her to the radio to hear Hitler speak. "Listen, Mamela," meaning little mother in affectionate Yiddish. My grandfather told her as the Führer's clipped, stentorian tones invaded their narrow sliver of a dimly lit kitchen. "This is a very bad man. We have to pay attention." Soon the bad man had killed his mother, father, sister, aunts, uncles, and cousins back in Europe. Every single person he ever knew and loved. In public, my grandfather lived a vibrant life dedicated to his congregation. At home, the air in their one-bedroom apartment was heavy with his sighs. The tragedies that surrounded my mother became part of her. Later, they became almost all of her. She was consumed by feelings of fear and unworthiness, but she managed to hold them at bay when I was a child. Looking back now, I see the signs of what was to come and how she panicked if I wandered steps away at the supermarket, how she forbade many normal childhood activities, climbing a tree, riding a horse that she deemed too dangerous. How she said she loved me so much that she would, if she could, wrap me up in cotton. She meant this as an expression of love. I understood that it was also a prison sentence. From an early age, we also stood on opposite sides of the fault line of religion. My mother raised me as an Orthodox Jew. No driving, TV, or phone calls on Shabbat. No McDonald's, no pepperoni pizza. But it never stuck. One of my earliest memories is surreptitiously watching Scooby-Doo on mute on Saturday mornings. Another is eating bacon, profoundly unkosher, deeply delicious bacon, on a school ski trip. This was partly because my family was a confusing grab bag of influences. On the one hand, my beloved grandfather, the rabbi, and my mother, the staunch loyalist. On the other hand, my father, a tacit atheist, whose gods were clearly science and literature. Also, I was a born skeptic. To this day, if you say X, I automatically think, what about Y? As an adult, this tendency is intellectually useful, though sometimes it drives my husband bonkers. As a girl, I couldn't see why we should keep kosher in the name of a god I doubted was real. But the real conflict between my mother and me didn't start until I was in high school, when the minor restrictions of childhood gave way to an ironclad code of chastity. No suggestive clothing, no unsupervised time with boys, ever. My mother even watched as I got my hair cut, chastising the hairdresser if he styled the angles too provocatively. Theoretically, the rules were religious and cultural in nature, but their real function was to serve as an anchor to keep my ship docked in my mother's harbor. When I followed the code, the ship rocked gently in her lapping waves. When I deviated from it, her gale-force anger tore us both to smithereens. By American standards of the 1980s, I was polite and responsible and a little too straight-laced. But invariably, I would break the rules, wear the wrong clothes, make the wrong friends, attend the wrong party, and panicked. Hostile accusations would follow. Waves of anger, floods of tears, days, then weeks of stony silence. During these wordless eternities, it was as if all love had drained from my soul. My stomach churned. I couldn't eat. But the weight I lost was nothing compared to the emotional hunger and the guilt I bore for making my mother so sad. My friends were bewildered when I reported these conflicts and the depths of my reaction to them. To them, I seemed, and probably was, the most rule-abiding girl in school. Got the highest grades, didn't smoke or do drugs. What more did my mother want? "Why don't you just say you're sleeping at my house," they would say, if we wanted to stay out late one night. They couldn't understand that my mother and I were so close that she could read my face more accurately than any lie detector test, or that the rules of my house were different from theirs. That to break them was not to commit an adolescent transgression, but to destroy my mother's fragile psyche. That if only I would do the right thing, my mother, whom I loved more than anyone and anything, would be happy again. And so would I. Since neither of us could stand being separated after each traumatic rupture, we always reconciled. The nurturing mother of my childhood always returned to me. We would hug, shed a few tears. I would lower myself gratefully into her warm bath of love and comfort. With each reunion, I believed the war was behind us. But it was never behind us. Over time, I learned to mistrust the ceasefires. I started to approach our house after school with a stomachache, grew skilled at gauging her mood the moment I entered. I felt I mustn't do anything to upset her equilibrium or trigger her rage. I became more aware of her childhood sorrows and of her present gaping maw of emptiness. I started to dream of escape, of the day I'd be free of her. But I also longed to stay. She was still my mother, and I wanted desperately, more than I've ever wanted anything before or since, to fill the chasm inside her, to take away her hurt. I couldn't think of my mother's tears, which I often caused without crying myself. As the youngest child, I mattered so much to her. I mattered too much. I mattered like the sun. To grow up was to condemn her to darkness. Back then, I still believed that there must be a way out of this conundrum, that somehow, if I did everything right, I could find a way to be myself and still make her happy. This article was edited due to time. in Relationships. The article is entitled The Essential Questions You Should Be Asking Your Therapist and the Most Essential Questions They Should Be Asking You. We asked three psychologists to share some of the questions their clients have responded to most. Charmaine Jackman, PhD, is the founder of InnoPsych, a Boston-based organization that helps people of color match with a therapist of color. Jenny Wang, PhD, is a former Duke University School of Medicine Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences assistant professor, now in private practice in Houston. And Diana Naranjo, PhD, is a professor of pediatrics at Stanford University with a private practice in San Francisco. We also asked them to share a few of the more memorable questions they've been asked by clients. Here's what they said. Questions these therapists ask at key moments. Whose hypercritical voice is that in your head? It's usually not your own, says Wang. So it is your dad's, your mom's, and old coaches? Figuring out that can help. When does this problem you have not exist, and what's different about those times? This question helps shift the focus from problems to solutions, says Jackman. What do you want more of? This is not a way to get clients to focus on the positive, says Naranjo. It's a way to shift them away from the feelings towards action. What do you feel isn't working in therapy? I ask the question again about 3 or 4 months in, then an annual basis if it's long term, says Naranjo. It lets me know if I need to be more or less directive or if we should try a different approach or really dig in. What are strategies or skills you have learned here that will help you respond to future obstacles? I am goals-oriented. At some point, we are going to wrap up, says Naranjo. I want patients to have a toolbox to take with them. This question helps clients see that the skills they've learned are transferable from a problem they've solved to things that will come up. Questions these therapists have been asked by clients. What are additional areas we haven't gotten into that you think we should? Some clients have patterns in which they are focused on pleasing or proving their work to others, says Wang. If this is a part of their relationship pattern, then we need to explore if and when the client feels as though they need to work really hard to be seen or valued by the therapist. Why are we talking about this particular topic? This is an opportunity to look at the original assessment and how, or if the current topic they're discussing in therapy is relevant, says Naranjo. It's also an opportunity for a client to change or adjust their goals. What kind of work have you done to confront your own biases? If the therapist has not done the work to become aware of and confront their own biases, this can potentially harm the client, Wang says. So, as a client, I would be interested in hearing about the work the therapist has done and examples of how it has impacted or changed their therapy practice. How do I talk to you if I feel like therapy isn't working? In our culture of politeness, it can feel adversarial to bring this up with the person who is trying to help you, says Jackman. Clients often need to know that it's not only okay to bring up what will help their therapy by better focusing it. How do you view my progress? When a client asks this question, we actually explore the motivation that prompted the question, says Wang. How will I know it's time to end therapy? Many portrayals of therapy can give the sense that it goes on forever, says Jackman. That is why it's important to talk with clients about goals and evaluate progress. In Wellness, we have an article on unexpected exercise mistakes we all make. Without expert supervision, our workouts can get sloppy. We asked experts to point out our most common workout mistakes and tell us how to fix them. Not thinking about your tongue while doing sit-ups. Women, particularly, tend to use their neck muscles more than their abs when doing crunches, which is very uncomfortable, says Haley Perlis, PhD, a sport and exercise psychology expert in Colorado. Shift the focus back to your abdominals by pressing your tongue against the roof of your mouth before starting your reps. This helps to keep the strain off your neck, forcing your stomach to do the work instead. Over-lunging. On the topic of form, it's really easy to strain your knees doing lunges and squats because people tend to step too far forward, so the knee extends past the front ankle and toes, says Sabrina P. Solani, DO Assistant Clinical Professor at the UCLA Department of Family Medicine and Orthopedics, an assistant team physician at UCLA Athletics. This causes pressure to be absorbed in the front of the knee rather than working out the appropriate muscles, she says. Check your lunge form by keeping your front heel pressed firmly on the ground. Or, if your knees just can't hack it, sub out the move for forward lunges or single leg bridges, which can achieve similar results, Solani says. Carrying your phone to the gym. Our phones drive us to distraction, and distraction can bung up our workouts, says Perlis. It's very easy to get lost in our phones, looking through playlists and workout videos, so much so that we can lose momentum during the workout and therefore not complete it to the best of our abilities, she says. Slouching. A weak core can lead to poor workout posture, which can lead to mistakes like back arching while doing overhead presses or push-ups, leaning too far to one side with single arm exercises, or losing balance with single leg exercises, says Solani. Instead, keep your core activated throughout each and every move you make by taking a deep breath as if you were bracing for a sucker punch to the stomach, from cardiovascular exercise to strength training. It also helps to keep your posture in check by engaging your core while sitting at your desk or walking. Being too diligent. Newbie runners tend to add miles to their jaunts too quickly without incorporating enough rest days. Failure to include adequate rest days can lead to muscle fatigue, poor form, and injury, Solani says. She often sees bone stress injuries and stress fractures due to this. Bone stress injuries mean the bones cannot tolerate a repetitive mechanical load. It is typically experienced as localized bone pain and pain that worsens with weight-bearing activities, she says. She says a rule of thumb is to start low and go slow. Limiting distance increases to no more than 10% each week, as per the American College of Sports Medicine. Craning to see what the instructor is doing, at home or in person. Perla says one of the biggest exercise mistakes she sees is ironically made when people try hard to get their workouts right. Contorting your neck to look at your screen or the instructor in the packed room can be a big mistake, she says. Instead, she recommends learning to rely on auditory cues during workouts as much as possible. At first, you may be watching and picking up on what the instructor is doing, but you must listen. Some instructors give excellent clues. You could also place your screen in your profile or directly in front of you. Try to position yourself so your back is never to the screen in order to maintain alignment and keep your head from turning too much, she says. In books, we have How to Write a Real Love Poem Without Clichés or Bad Rhymes. The poet and author of Skeletons shares her tips for writing a love poem, as well as some surprises. It's the time of year when my students write love poems. This arrival always surprises me, as spring's green shocks after months of winter gray, but it shouldn't. It's as predictable as the city's daffodils pushing through the trash to shiver in the wind. Forget the saccharine of greeting cards and the sing-song of roses are red, violets are blue. Love poems can be moving, beautiful, romantic. Yes, they can express affection for a beloved person, but the poems we need most have skin in the game and something more profound at stake. It felt easier to write poems about longing and desire as a young woman, but as the years have passed, I've found that, just as sustaining a relationship isn't always easy, writing love poems about a love marriage can be a challenge. How do you see the person you've lived with for decades as if for the first time? How do you make the 10,000th kiss romantic and new? As much as we may want or need to write a love poem, it's often difficult to find a language that adequately expresses the way we feel. For one thing, it's hard to strike the right tone. When a poem is flooded with too much emotion, it becomes sentimental, even cheesy. But when a poem risks nothing, it leaves a reader cold. The best love poems enact the hyper-aware state of being alive we feel when we're in love. Everything is suddenly technicolor. There are days we live as if death were nowhere in the background, from joy to joy to joy, from wing to wing, from blossom to blossom to impossible blossom. Lee Young Lee writes, capturing love's fleeting jubilance. Rita Dove's Flirtation works a similar magic, reminding us that my heart is humming a tune I haven't heard in years. The poem encourages us not to miss the world's deliciousness. Quiet's cool flesh, let's sniff and eat it. There are ways to make of the moment a topiary, so the pleasure's in walking through. The most powerful love poems, I think, address the fact that we are here now and one day won't be. Keats's Ode on Melancholy is an exquisite example. Keats knew immense suffering in his day. He lived through his generation's pandemic and lost his mother and his brother to tuberculosis before succumbing himself at 25. Yet he admonishes the reader not to retreat from life, but rather, when the melancholy fit shall fall, then glut thy sorrow on a morning rose. His advice? Move through the world, embracing its pleasures, hearts open, despite knowing full well we will lose our beloveds, will indeed lose everything on this whole spinning beautiful earth. Love poems help us celebrate the gift of being alive, even, perhaps especially during challenging times. The past few years may have left us bruised, but are we done with life? I am still so into it. The buzz of meeting a friend for a drink now that we can once again meet friends for drinks. The student who wants to come by my in-person office hours to hang out and read poems. My husband beside me as he sleeps. As I type, he is still here on earth breathing. And I am. One day I know it will be otherwise, notes the poet Jane Keenan. But for now. One afternoon, just when the city seemed to me emerging from the first crush of the pandemic, I was cutting through Central Park after an appointment. The meadow was mostly empty. Folks still working from home. Tourists hadn't come back. But giant speakers streamed Jay-Z's Empire State of Mind, that ironic love poem to New York City. The few of us out walking that morning were in luck. We could dance a little, or at least step with a bounce. No one's looking. Life rebounding in New York City. The full force of it, joy. People do know they're alive, says Alex Dimitrov in Love and Other Poems. The best love poems offer respite and revivify. They remind me that I, too, love being alive. Soon the lilacs will bloom, but so briefly. Even more reason to seek them out and breathe in deep. And this is what I most want out of love poems. I want to embrace the powerful life force that surges up again and again, despite the years passing, despite the heartache and disappointments, the losses and griefs, despite it all. Ecstasies by Deborah Landau. In the XYZs of nights and days we stayed, as if the conversation would go on forever. You, 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 ample days of you. Your beard accumulating a bit of snow, the gradual showing of bone, a grizzled diminishment, the stacked up winters, each in its place. In this manner, the years spooled out the other side as if in plain view, a field without you. Meanwhile, we took good care. The greens were organic. Honey sweetened the pot. The membrane between us stayed transparent, and we took seriously our allegiance to dream. Flesh by Deborah Landau. It must give pleasure, but it rarely does. But pleasure is so useful when it comes. Pleasure says this is your sort of place, your year. You live here. Pleasure's the perfect swerve. It wins you back. Pain won't take you nowhere. Chocolate on the tongue. Vodka. Velvet. Voila. A zipper slinking in its silver, its long slide down. From Oprah's Insiders. Oprah on the first Father's Day without her dad. Hi, Insiders. Happy Sunday to you and happy Father's Day to those of you who are dads and who choose to honor this day. This is a bittersweet day for me because it is the first Father's Day I've spent on the planet Earth without my father. As I shared here several months after he passed, I feel his spiritual presence even more profoundly now than I did when he was in the flesh and could touch and hug me. As we reflect on Father's Day in this country and what it means, I think of what my father really gave to me. He took me in when I desperately needed to have the trajectory of my life changed. I was in trouble and got sent to live with my father. More than just a home and shelter, what he provided was a sense of guidance and a decision-making in my life that really turned it around for me. The thing that I value the most that my father has given to me is a sense of work ethic and integrity with that work. No matter what, I always choose to do the right thing, especially when no one is looking. And I know that that came from watching my father be the kind of person who did the right thing when no one was looking, and watching him not just speak about it, but to live doing the right thing whenever it was necessary. And so, as we celebrate this day, I'd like to hear from you all on what are the major lessons, or what is the greatest gift your father or the father figure in your life gave to you. Leave it in the comments below. I know you all will have something thoughtful and beautiful and memorable, and have a blessed day this Father's Day. Go well. In favorite things, we have the JWPEI Aylin, AYLIN canvas phone bag. It's $40 at Amazon. Have someone on your list whose cell is always attached to their hip? This crossbody makes life easier. It fits most phones, but has slots for credit cards and comes in cheery colors. And we also have the Benevolence LA Velvet Travel Jewelry Box Organizer, $20 at Amazon. Nobody wants their jewelry jingle-jangling freely in their suitcase. This jazzy velvet travel case keeps your prized pieces stylishly contained with spaces for rings, bracelets, and necklaces. And it's small enough to stash in your purse. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, nzreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.